It is Saturday, June 18th, 2011, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, geek news and your questions and comments about technology.
The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI.
It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxel. So please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today's theme song is by Dave Proterra, Pet Star Music. Thank you so much for submitting your theme. If you'd like to create some music for Geek Speak for our themes, please feel free to do so and send us some email. Our show is a Creative Commons endeavor. Share, share alike. As long as you give us some credit, you're welcome to do anything you'd like with the content of our show. In the second half of the show, I'm going to invite you to call us with questions and comments about technology. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. I'm Lyle Troxel. In the air with me, we have Mr. Miles Elam. He's a software engineer and political junkie. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning.
We also have Lindsay Lonnie, and she's a system analyst. Good morning, Lindsay.
Good morning.
Lindsay, I'd love to start with you, if you don't mind.
Sure.
You want to tell me, I won't surprise you with which one of the stories I like of yours. You go ahead and pick the one you want.
Okay. So the Obama administration is leading a global effort to deploy shadow internet and mobile phone systems that dissidents can use to undermine repressive governments that are seeking to silence them by censoring or shutting down telecom networks. And so through the shadow network effort, basically the New York Times reported this, and it says that it involves activities such as building a mesh network of suitcase-housed wireless internet access points, which is my favorite part
of
it.
Yeah, that's cool.
And then another $50 million project seeks to build an independent mobile phone network in Afghanistan that the Taliban can't shut down, because what they're doing is shutting down at 6 p.m. and restarting at 6 a.m. so that we can't monitor communications via phone, because that's usually how they get their stuff done at night, I guess. And then a third shadow network, which is supposedly not a U.S. project, involves dissidents who bury mobile phones near the North Korea border for surreptitious communications.
Interesting. Bury phones?
Yeah, they bury them in the sand.
How does that help them communicate?
Well, I think people go and unbury them.
Okay.
And dig them up. But the Internet Suitcase Project is part of the Open Technology Initiative at the New America Foundation, which is a nonpartisan research group. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of neat going to their website and looking at the technologies they're evaluating for putting into this suitcase. They're hoping that it's innocuous looking enough that they can get it across borders, just looking like regular technology equipment, and then they can place them wherever it needs to be so that there can be an alternate communication network out there.
And they're not talking about necessarily using satellites phone systems in this. They're just talking about making a local network.
Right, like a Wi-Fi, just a Wi-Fi network.
A mesh network's really interesting. Traditionally, the way that we set up network points is we connect our DSL line to a Wi-Fi point, and then sometimes we have a second Wi-Fi point that's a hop. But in general, it's kind of a one Wi-Fi point connected to hardware, right. Hardwire. And then from there, you just get served connectivity. But mesh networks are a little more interesting than that. You keep on adding...
And a lot more complex.
More complex, yeah. You keep on adding an access point, and the access points themselves just need power of some sort. And then if they see another access point, they relay traffic back and forth. And if you set up enough of these, you can theoretically have your own network, even if you have none of them connected to a hardwire. And I would assume, like in a city environment, if you got enough of these suitcases, you could still have really good communications through these things.
Well, one of the limitations with a mesh network, and this is also a limitation with using, for example, the Apple Airport, where you have a few chained together, mm-hmm. other items like we set up on the property at one point,
right.
is that you do reduce the amount of bandwidth as you go through the various hops. And that's one of the limitations of mesh networks, is that every time you have to, it has to figure out what's the shortest path, but also... If you have five nodes in between, you have that latency and you have all the contention with all the other nodes trying to get out.
Even just the basic idea of one node, if it's communicating to two nodes, it has to have its bandwidth so that it can communicate to one and to the other, and therefore it's going to reduce the amount of communication it can do.
Right. At the same time, if you don't have access to internet connectivity, really good internet connectivity, that is, it's much better than anything else.
Yeah.
The One Laptop Per Child project has
mesh network capabilities
where
right.
they were going up to a kilometer away from one another at the very extreme ends of it. But for people who are used to a high level of connectivity, like for example, even now with our smartphones, the mesh networks have not been able to keep pace. That's why we haven't seen them.
But in an environment where you don't actually have a connectivity, but you want people to communicate, setting up a network of any kind, and then hopefully somewhere in that network, somebody says, well, actually, I have a cell site, you know, satellite connection. And then the entire mesh network theoretically has network connectivity. Not very fast, of
right.
course.
Well, all sharing the same thing and then having the network latency.
But, you know, this is when we saw internet as we see internet traffic get shut down in places, clearly the way to solve this, and especially if, you know, counselors are saying that internet connectivity is a human right, you'd want to be able to shoot, you know, fly in network connectivity.
Right. It's just interesting also that it's government funded, and I don't know if there's a whole other discussion that can happen around that, but I think it's kind of neat.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's been in the geeky space as like a social movement for a long time. There was a group in Santa Cruz that wanted to create a mesh network we had on the show years ago to talk about, you know, well, if you did this, you can still get extremely fast connectivity between the nodes, faster than your DSL line, if you will, if you set up the network correctly. And of course, with that, you can do sharing that's not monitor or even goes to the internet.
Right.
Right. It's one of those things I'm always looking at. In fact, I spent too much time one day this last week looking at the San Juan Valley, where both Miles and I live and a few of other friends live, about where there's line of sight. So using Google Earth, I just kind of took a look at, can you contact these different points? And if you can, you buy, you know, $200 worth of hardware, and all of a sudden you've got gigabit between your houses. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
And when you're in a situation where, you know, I've got like the GeekSpeak archive of the WAV files, if you will. They're always on my machines at home, and there's no other, I'm pretty good backup, but there's not actually a copy anywhere else. And so if I could hook up with Miles and he could do a sync of that, if you would, it'd be kind of nice. Of course, it's kind of a terabyte and a half at this point, so it's not an easy thing to pass around. So I'm always kind of curious by that idea of, yeah, we can use the network. We can always go through an AT&T or Comcast in this area, but wouldn't it be nice if we were producing our own networks, especially yeah. locally? And mesh network seems to be the way to do it.
Right. And I wonder how to filter out in a case where you've got like Egypt and you have a bunch of people wanting to upload pictures and data, and the network is sort of limited. How is that going to be filtered out so it's not just flooded with everyone trying to send their information to the internet? You know,
yeah.
that'll be interesting to see how they do that.
Yeah. And P2P actually would work wonderfully here if everyone is doing the same thing. If you're trying to download multiple things, you're still limited by that wherever your bandwidth is at the access point.
Point to point? In what way? What are you saying?
But if you're trying to download something and you have a nice big mesh network.
Oh, yeah.
And you're all downloading the same thing.
No big deal.
Yeah.
What you're saying is that one person's actually going to get one fragment of the file through. There's only each of the fragments of the file, if you will, is only going to go through that slow connection to the internet once, and then it gets shared really rapidly.
Right.
Right. And it does make sense that the hardware package of this briefcase that the government's trying to suggest is going to be one thing, but the software on it is going to be really important to limit the amount of replication of content, and to ensure that content is spread easy. You know, it's
right.
not like having these really fat pipes. Everybody's connected to some network. All right, let's move on. Miles, I'm not sure what your news stories are because you're not using this wonderful little wiki we use. So I'll just have to say hi.
Hi.
Don't you look sharp today? Go on.
I was thinking about passwords. We've talked about it in the past. And right now we have this wonderful treasure trove of information about what passwords are being used.
I love that stats. You're talking about like what's the percentages of which passwords people use? Like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 is really
common. Also, there was an app that was recently denied by the Apple App Store called Big Brother. And this was a competitor for the passcode.
They've already have that app?
Yeah.
Just not called that. It's called it.
It looks exactly or almost exactly like the passcode screen for the main iPhone.
Yeah.
The idea is that you want to leave your phone on, but you don't want to shut it off, like you want to just stay on the passcode screen. And Apple has recently decided they want to have it pulled, and the whole big hubbubaloo about that. But don't want to get into that. What we do want to talk about is the person who wrote that app deciding, let's take a look, because most of the time people are just going to use the same pad that for their phone that they do for this app, so they don't have to remember things.
Mm-hmm.
He's making the assumption that there's going to be a high correlation among the people that are using this app. And by default, the passcode screen has a 4-digit key.
Yes.
Which, by the way, is pretty small, but that's, you can set it up for higher now. But
oh, you can?
Anyway, yeah.
So I'm just going to just describe this real quick. An iPhone touchscreen interface, when you can lock it in a normal way where so that it's not going to call your grandma when it's in your pocket. That's a common thing. You just push the button on the top and it gets in this lock mode. To unlock that, you just use your finger to slide it across. But if you're like me and you've got young kids and you leave your phone around, having it unlocked like that's no good because then they can get into your email and start sending messages to Pimp Daddy, and that's no good. So I'll describe that. So what you do is you set up a lock screen, which means that when you slide it open, then you actually have to enter 4 numbers. And that kind of protects your phone from other people using it. Okay. Mm-hmm. So this Big Brother app looks just like that, but actually isn't the lock. I have no idea why you'd use that app instead of the iPhone's built-in. Does it have better features?
I think it's the idea of leaving the phone on, leaving services on.
Okay.
And you don't want to have it just go to just pulling mail and nothing else.
Okay.
I don't know exactly.
Mm-hmm.
But at any rate, as expected, the most commonly used passcode is 1234, followed by distant second by 0000.
Mm-hmm.
And then goes down from there. Although the numbers where you're using the same number over and over again, like 1111, 5555, are all fairly common. So if you have one of those, yeah, don't use those.
Yeah, why even use it? Unless, of course, you're just trying to protect yourself from your 2-year-old using your phone.
Okay. That's true. And at the same time, when I was talking about recent passwords being leaked, there's a group called LulzSec, who's been doing a fair amount of internet vigilantism, hacking, for example, the Sony PlayStation Network and hacking various websites. And they just published 62,000 random logins and passwords, so emails and passwords.
Okay.
And so people have been looking through there. Some of them looking through just for the sake of, am I on this list?
You mean of the ones they've hacked that they found? So they've gotten 60,000, here's the email, here's the password.
Right.
Are you on the list?
I am not.
Okay. I gotta go see.
And not surprisingly, most common password, 123456.
So on the computer, when you can type anything you want, you're not limited to the numbers you are on the iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
It's still the same number.
Right. And second place, the more secure option,
123456789. Oh my gosh.
The third most common password being,
you know,
password.
Every once in a while, that's just a random number. Password is the... Are these the polite ones? Because, of course,
these are the ones that are
most
commonly used.
What's the right solution? What's our update this month on what the right solution is for a good password?
Well, no, I just want to do these little snippets. I don't want to go into a long tirade we did last time.
Right. No,
I just want to put these last snippets so that people get into this habit of knowing, that's just a really bad idea to do that password. I need to choose something
last
else.
Last time we did this, I suggested getting a password manager. There was two of them that we talked about during the show. I liked 1Password. The other one we talked about, I don't even remember what it was, but they got hacked the following week. So I've been using 1Password. They haven't been hacked.
Ben brought up his solution, which I thought was an excellent one, which is find a method for generating a password.
Yeah, but make it long.
Right, but I mean, even so... Yeah. Each individual person, if they have a slightly different method, you've made the variation.
The trouble with a method system like that is that if you have a rogue administrator that knows what your password is and they can figure out your method, and you'll think that probably they won't, they might be able to. If they can, they'll be able to know all your passwords. So you need to have it, and that's a problem.
Sure.
But it's better, of course, than using 1Password for everything, because then if you have the rogue admin, he definitely knows, or she definitely knows. But... 1Password.
The rogue admin, I don't know if is really that big of an issue. Yes, theoretically it is, but really the issue is that these sites that have sites that are handling credit card numbers, mm-hmm. and sites that are handling large amounts of users
doesn't save
are getting hacked, and those passwords are kept in plain text on the database.
Right, right, right.
So that's the real big issue.
So a big thing you do when you look for a system like this, so 1Password, to sync your passwords, if you will, between different accounts, it uses the method of take that file and actually put it in an open system that you can then get access to. And that system that it uses is called Dropbox, and it's this free service we've talked about before on the show. Basically, you set up this app on your 2 computers. When you put things in this location, it syncs between the two. It's like kind of like an auto rsync. It's very simple. It gets stored on their servers, and all the verbiage they used for their site talks about it being secure. Lindsay, give us the bad news, would you?
Sure. I'm just going to launch into Dropbox.
Yeah.
So Dropbox is an online file storage and sharing site that, you know, you can have things shared between your home computer, your work computer, and, you know, any other place, your iPhones, your Androids. And basically, recently, it's admitting that it can see the data that you've stored, whereas previously, a lot of users were thinking that it was private in the way that nobody at Dropbox could even see the files that were being processed or handled. Previously, it was discovered that copying a file from one computer to another eliminated the necessity to log on to Dropbox with your password on the second computer. But it's not a huge security hole because a potential cracker still has to be able to get onto your computer to grab the file from a second machine.
Mm-hmm.
But more recently, a doctoral candidate, Christopher Segoin, I think that's how you say his name, he noticed an inconsistency with their messaging that they're giving to the consumers. He found that when you set up a Dropbox account, you establish a folder on your PC that's shared and synced with similar folders on other PCs, Macs, iPads, mobile devices, whatever. You brand the folder and its contents with an email address and password. In order to get into the folder online or wherever, you have to provide the correct email address and password. You might assume that you're the only person with the password for your folder. And that's what most people assume, is that, you know, that's their password. Nobody else can see that password. But what he found is an anomaly that Dropbox was claiming, quote, all files stored on Dropbox servers are encrypted with AES-256 and are inaccessible without your account password. Yet they also claim, if we detect that a file you're trying to upload has already been uploaded to Dropbox, we don't make you upload it again or change it. So there's an inconsistency. He's like, well, how are you allowing a partial upload of the file and doing matching?
So the basic idea is that my files are totally safe. So if I take a file that's just a picture of my dog and I put it up on Dropbox, and then what they theoretically do is they take that file and they encrypt it with my password, and they don't know my password. Mm-hmm. So now, without knowing my password, they can't actually find out what the file is.
Right.
And an encrypted file looks like noise. It actually is indeterminable from noise. That's kind of the definition of encryption. So now I upload another picture, and what they're claiming is that they're going to know somehow that the picture is the same thing.
Right.
And how would they know that?
Without your password.
And more than that, for text files, they know, they can actually tell you a diff of it. So if I have a picture that's if I have a file that's 4 paragraphs of text and I've changed one word, they're going to actually know that it's only one paragraph that got modified or one word that got modified. And that's just not mathematically possible.
Right.
So what's the solution here? Were they claiming they could do something they couldn't do, or are they doing something they aren't supposed to do?
Maybe it's a little of both. They're mostly just claiming that they could do something they couldn't do. They need the password in order to see
to
the difference
the
of the file. So they are using your password information, and they do have access to that information. And so they've just changed their wording on their site. This person filed with the FTC requesting that they notify all their users that they have access to this information. And there was also another incident where they submitted information to the government when the government requested the information of them. And before, their wording made it seem like it was totally private and that sort of thing wouldn't happen. So they've since changed all of their agreement wording to basically say if they need to, they have access to the information.
Okay, so the question I have next is, are my password still secure?
Right.
Yeah.
And it doesn't say anything about that in the article, but, you know, their tech support, so, you know, one person is speculating, and I have no idea if it's true, that, you know, people in their tech support would have had to have access to that information in order to help people with their files. So, you know, maybe just go change your password if you have Dropbox, just to be safe.
It's of course, more complicated than that for me, because I have an encrypted file, theoretically, that's totally safe on my Dropbox, which happens to have, encryptedly, all my passwords, right? So it's an extremely sensitive file for me. And to my knowledge, Dropbox has no idea what the file is, because, of course, when I have it on my machine, it's encrypted such with a pretty long phrase that it would be actually pretty hard to crack, even if you had the file. Mm-hmm. And that's essential because, of course, cracking, even when you talk about cracking along a large password, it's just a matter of time. And if you have a local copy of the thing to try against, you can try for a long time. Mm-hmm. Miles, let's move on with other things, please. Your next story, I have no idea. let's make it more positive, I hope.
Sure. One of the concerns that some people have is that with the cargo containers being shipped around, going to various ports around the world, that one of them may contain a nuclear weapon.
That would be a problem.
Yes. However, a gentleman by the name of Taylor Wilson has found a way of detecting these just by with a handheld device that you just walk by, as opposed to having to open up the containers and go searching through them. Found a way to detect nuclear devices. Fun fact, he's 17.
Nice.
And it works by a quirk of nuclear fusion where if you bombard some radioactive material with neutrons, that you're going to have an excess come back through the reaction. So he had to have a fuser, a nuclear fusion reactor.
Of course.
Right. Well, I mean, those aren't that hard to make. Any hobbyist can make them. You just can't make one that generates more power than it consumes.
Right.
It just, but he made this fuser when he was 14. Just a nice point of reference.
Wow. That's okay. Something to have on your CV.
Yeah. So he was just honored at the Intel International Science Fair. So good for him. Just wanted to put that out there.
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
That's not
if you're a teenager. Like you can, dude, you can make big differences things. As long as you study math and science.
Yeah,
which the U.S. is a little
don't. I said a positive story. I said a positive story.
Yes, no, yes. This particular individual, this particular high school student, is bucking the trend of the fact that American school children rank 25th in math and 21st in science out of 30 developed countries.
There's another article I read like that recently about a kid that started programming at 6 and 7, and he just sold his first software program at 14. He lives in Seattle, so I'll post that with your article.
Sold it, huh? I could get my kids on to work.
Yeah, put them to work.
All right.
I thought you already had your kids working in the salt mines.
Yeah, that's right. I do. all right, let's do that whole business we do in the middle of the show thing, shall we? GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Home and Small Business Tech, providing IT support to businesses, tech support for home computers. Home and Business Tech specialize in protecting data and have been providing data storage, recovery, virtualization, and maintenance for over 10 years. HASBTech.com. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP. My name is Lyle Troxell. This is GeekSpeak. In the air with me, we have Miles Elam and Lindsay Lonnie. We are taking calls with questions and comments about technology. You can call us about anything you'd like. The number is 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. A little bit of a follow-up and correction about show on the 11th that we talked about a 12-year-old listener who has a computer that keeps on shutting down. And one thing that we didn't talk about would be the hardware issue. It could, of course, be a hardware issue. I think we talked about the hard drive and we talked about the OS being a problematic thing and suggested using Ubuntu Linux from CD. First off, a listener recommended that don't do Ubuntu Linux from CD. Do it from a USB drive. It's a lot easier, and then the machine, you can actually edit and use things. Additionally, you can install Ubuntu on top of your normal Windows partition without damaging Windows at all. It will detect it, and it will move things out of the way for you. So there's your two solutions there. Download to put on a USB drive, or install it on your current hard drive. Now, for the machine that's the restarting, another thing it could be is a hardware issue with the computer. The cheaper motherboards use cheaper parts, and it's not uncommon for capacitors to go bad. So the caller here was...
For bad capacitors to go bad. Yeah.
For cheap capacitors to fail. And so this is called the capacitor plague, and I've never heard of it, but sure enough, there's a whole Wikipedia page about it. Often computers, motherboards are made in Taiwan. Though I think that's probably not the best way to judge of where it was made. It was probably much more about how it was sold. Because, of course, factory might be making cheap boards and expensive
boards. Right, but there was a correlation that the Japanese-made ones were of higher quality in general. The pattern that people were finding, the ones in other parts of Southeast Asia, were not as consistent.
So this question was, can you replace the capacitors? And you can replace capacitors on a motherboard. I don't think it's worth your time unless you've got a lot of time.
And if you're willing to say, well, that's $150 down the drain.
Exactly. Exactly. Because when you mess up, you'll mess up.
Yeah. Dude. If you're willing to do that, like, it's a great experience. Like, it's being able to fix your own things. It's like being able to fix your own car, being able to, you know, plant your own food.
I have fixed a lot of electronics in my day. Mm-hmm. I've made a lot of electronics failed. And I think the failure rate's higher than the fix rate.
Yes.
And that's mostly because, I don't know what's wrong. I'll open it up. Like, look. Remember the Vaya laptop that we had for a while?
Yeah, I also remember a little home theater PC setup we had. Like, tried doing, this still didn't work. Another friend of mine where I had a stereo that failed. I was like, oh, well, if it's broken, let me try it. I can try to fix it. And he went and tried to solder something in, and he got it. Okay, that should work. And then we hit the power, and another part of the board just completely just... Right. I don't think that's going to get fixed by changing a fuse.
The good thing is, you know, after that point that it's really broken. There's no
The great thing
here.
At that point is you also know, yeah, I need to check my methodology in the future.
Yes. All right. The other correction / suggestion is we suggested using Open Office instead of Office for if you're instead of buying the Office suite. Go ahead and use Open Office. I still recommend it.
Six months ago, that would have been great advice.
Yeah. OpenOffice is great. Still, it's the default install for Ubuntu Linux. That's what you get. But there's another one. There's LibreOffice, which is an awesome app as well.
It's actually a fork of OpenOffice.
Right. And the point about the fork is that, one, OpenOffice is maintained and managed by Sun, which was recently bought by Oracle. And Oracle says, yeah, not so much newer. And LibreOffice is more free than that, of course. Freedom. and the fork happened prior to the merger, or now is being developed. In parallel, if you will.
Yeah, the general consensus was that Oracle was falling down on its stewardship of it. They weren't trying to find a way to monetize it and not getting a good reception to it.
The other solution, if you'd like to just be able to view the documents that come in, Microsoft offers a free viewer for their documents. It's called Microsoft Office Viewers. There's maybe multiples of them. And you can download that to view the documents you're getting, but you won't be able to do much with them. That's all for the updates and such. Anybody have a geek bit for today before we start going to calls? And again, the phone number, 1-800-655-5877. And everything we talk about on GeekSpeak, of course, is available to you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, all blah, 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 up at geekspeak.org.
I have a cool image, but it means you have to go to the website
this
after
is
the
radio.
Show.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. It means you have to go to the website after the show, geekspeak.org. And it's basically talking about the internet in 60 seconds. What happens on an average 60 seconds on the internet? How many emails are sent? How much cool music is streamed from Pandora? How many calls go over Skype? That type
awesome
of thing.
So that's your geek bit.
That's my geek bit,
representation of 1 minute.
Is it a graph?
Yes.
Cool.
Yes, it's an infographic.
Okay.
You have 40.
It's very colorful.
You have 40 seconds left to talk about this.
Have you?
Because it's a minute. You got to talk about it for a minute. Right? All right, let's go ahead and start taking calls with questions and comments about technology. If you'd like to be in the hopper for asking us questions or giving us comments about the show, please feel free to call us 1-800-655-5877.
Fine. Here's another little geek tidbit. Right. The average human being has 60 new genetic mutations.
New?
New.
Really?
How new?
Were not inherited from their parents.
Whoa.
60. Wow. 60. So there's a lot of non-necessary stuff.
Except for the whole, like, the number of genes that we have in our body is 60 is actually not that large a number. But yeah.
Oh, that's really interesting. Not tradable. I mean, not things that have necessarily something you could detect.
It depends. But
I always thought you were a little wonky compared to your dad.
Yeah, considering how wonky my dad is, that's saying something.
From the Czech Republic, Prague, Mark, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi, am I on the air?
Yes, you are.
Great. I have a hardware question for you. I hope you can help me.
I do too. You're calling a long enough distance that I hope we can help you.
So I'm trying to hook up my laptop so I can watch the screen on my television.
Yes.
Because I like to stream things like The Daily Show and stuff like that. And I'd like to watch it on the TV rather than the laptop. Picture's better. You know, you can see it from different angles, all that kind of stuff.
It's bigger.
But when I plug in the RGB cable to my laptop, the screen goes from a sort of a landscape, and then the two sides get cut off and it goes black. And I just get a square screen.
I take it your TV is not a widescreen.
It is a widescreen.
Oh, but
yeah.
But you have like RGB cables.
Which is going black? That your main screen on your computer?
The main screen on the computer, when I plug in the RGB cable and I have a signal from the TV, when the, in other words, the TV is on, the two sides, I'm not explaining it very well, but if you have like a rectangle on its side, that's my screen. Mm-hmm. And then I get two big black strips on the left and right, and I get my desktop and all the images and windows contract into a square.
Your TV,
I can still see my background image.
So it still works.
Your TV exporter is expecting a standard definition 4x3 resolution TV. That's what's happening. And your laptop is just reflecting that portion. So you have a mirror between the two screens.
The RGB cable that you're getting across, are you splitting it from the RGB to your computer? Are you splitting into coaxial cables?
I don't think so. It plugs straight
in. The cable looks the same on both sides.
Yep.
Okay. All right. So what's happening? Miles is totally right on this. What's happening is the handshaking that's going on between the two systems are defaulting to a TV, traditional TV, four by three.
The TV doesn't know anything about it. It's actually happening on the hardware that's connected to the laptop.
Yeah. Have you and are you using a Windows machine or what are you using for your?
Yeah, I'm on a Windows and it's a Toshiba Satellite.
And have you tried going into the desktop preferences and changing the resolution of the TV?
Of the TV or the
inside your laptop, display preferences, if you will. I think it's under desktop. Have you tried going in there and changing sizes?
I've tried going into screen resolution and changing sizes,
There's no choices there.
There is. There's only two choices. Actually, there's several choices, but it doesn't seem to impact the screen. Let me try this here.
Yeah. So in your
it's probably changing between like a simulator.
Now the TV is registered, but now it's distorted on the TV.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what's happening here is both of the systems are going to try to do their best to do what the other one wants. That's what they're doing to each other, right? So the TV says, "Oh, look, I've got a signal like this. Let me switch to that." Or the TV says, "I can do this," and the computer says, "Well, can you do this?" And that handshaking is not working correctly. But there's a complication added to this, and that is that the TV, because of the HD standards, it's very the manufacturers in the early days of high definition TVs, if you will. There's all these restrictions and protocols of what you can send high signals to and what you can't. And it is common for the RGB to not be able to be a high end. The HDMI port's the one that you want to have the higher resolution. But that shouldn't be the case for an RGB connector.
Actually, just a quick question. Are you using component cables or a composite cable? And that means
I don't know what the difference is.
Right. Do you have
I already asked this, Miles.
Oh, you do? Have three cables?
The cables look the same on both sides. So it's an RGB component.
Yes, it's the same on both sides.
Exactly. Oh, it's a composite. Okay.
And the thing, composite's not really the right term to say on that.
They are sold as RCA composite video cable.
That's a bad name, though. But
sorry.
Because composite infers that the signal's actually cross-talking, and it's not. It's individual signals.
So I went to my screen resolution, and I originally was trying to do my screen resolution through the control panel.
Uh-huh.
And I went through the desktop, like you just suggested,
and it
seems to be working.
Yeah, through the desktop space, it should show you your layout, and there should be two different screens. And you should be able to click on the smaller of the ones, and then you can change that.
So I'm sorry if I missed this as part of the conversation, but is that component connector, that RCA cable?
Did you miss that it's working now? Did you miss that part?
Sorry, go on. Is it connected directly to your laptop, or do you have a separate dongle?
No, it goes straight from the TV to the laptop.
Okay.
Okay. Why?
So because there's no handshake going on.
Right.
The device within the device, as it just detects, is there a signal there or not?
Yeah. Okay, cool. So you're set up.
I'm set up.
Cool. 11 years and we got one right. All right, cool. Thanks so much for the call. And you are in Prague?
I am indeed.
Now, why are you calling us?
Because I couldn't get somebody here who could help me.
and for
my
some
text
reason,
is not good enough that I could go in and ask people.
For some reason, you don't sound like you're a native to the Czech Republic.
No, I'm from the U.S. originally.
Well, thanks for calling.
And I can listen to you guys online.
Ah, great. Thanks so much for calling. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Ooh, technology.
That's so cool.
And imagine if we were to upgrade our hardware, we'd be able to support more people over the internet and get a
thank you very much for your donations. We did match our grants. We will be upgrading the studio gear. I'm very excited.
Yay.
However, if you still want to donate, that's fine.
Yes, my home phone number is... From Aptos, a little closer to home, Nimi, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi, thank you.
Can you speak up?
Sure.
Sure, what's your question?
Hi, well, Lyle, we know you from Miracle on 34th Street.
Oh, Jeremy, wonderful.
My son Jeremy was an elf.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so he graduated junior high. He's going into high school, and we wanted to get him a laptop for a gift, graduation gift.
Okay, but is he listening right now?
Yes.
Okay, I don't know if he deserves it. No, go on.
he would rather have an iPad.
Hmm.
So we don't know now. We want to weigh out the pros and cons, and we don't know what to get him, an iPad or a laptop.
Okay, first off, the high school that Jeremy's going into, does it allow students to use anything at the school that's not like pencil and paper? I would do that first. Take a look at the school policy and rules. The high school in the San Lorenzo Valley, for example, does not allow portable devices of any kind. They might allow laptops, but they do not allow phones and things, right? And they get confiscated if they have them, that kind of thing. So that's a junior high. So there's different rules at different schools, and you definitely want to be in line with the rules in the schools. The next thing is the teacher. Even if the school says it doesn't have a policy, the teacher might have a policy on it. And I would find it highly unlikely that a high school teacher will allow a laptop in class for taking notes.
Okay.
Oddly enough, they might allow an iPad for taking notes. it's more clearly what you're doing at the time. So check that first. And then next, the idea here is that Jeremy's going to be going back and forth from home and stuff, and sometimes there'll be times when he wants to do schoolwork and stuff. I think the iPad would probably function pretty well. The typing aspect of it's lousy without a keyboard. Miles, what's your thought?
Yeah, the typing issue is an issue. You probably want to have a dock that has a keyboard attached to it to do anything substantial.
Which is an extra like $100, like that.
I think you can get them for cheaper than that, but yeah, that's generally the case. Although you can get Bluetooth keyboards as well at work with
right.
it, but then you have to hold up the iPad, and it's a whole other issue.
It's going to save
it's
money.
It's probably not going to be as fast as just writing down notes on a pad and paper.
That's right.
So
okay.
And the next thing you have to deal with is, you know, how is the homework assignment going to be turned in, right? So you've got it on your laptop. Now you either have to sync the app data, print through wireless printing, which some printers support on the iPad. Getting that data to the teacher is going to be difficult unless the teacher allows emailing, and then it will be relatively easy. So again, this is a teacher question. Of course, with high school, it's seven teachers or six teachers question,
right?
And that makes it more complicated. But I think if Jeremy, here's the next thing. This is going to be my default thing with kids. As long as you trust your kids' choices on privacy and they understand that and security, then trust them on the technology that they want to use. Because the neophytes in the world are increase as their age increases, right? Miles and I and Lindsay are very technically savvy people. But I bet you a 15-year-old would come in here that plays with computers and totally know everything more than we do about the stuff that's currently going on, right? I learn the stuff that I know, a lot of the new technology that I'm dealing with, from younger people. They just happen to be involved more. It's more a part of their life.
No day job.
Did I? There is that. They have a lot more time. Do you agree with that, you guys? What do you think?
Yeah, and I think there's the cool factor, you know?
Yeah.
Kids want the iPods, and, you know, they want whatever everyone else has. But the other thing that I normally think of, for me, is sometimes I drop things. And
yep.
I've got a laptop that's a tank because of that, mm-hmm. and I've dropped it a few times, and it doesn't even, you know, the hard drive doesn't even hiccup.
Yeah.
But if I had an iPad, I'm, you know,
it
I don't know if
like
it would
It might look
like
my iPhone. It might be broken.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah. There's a practical
yeah,
side
Yeah, you definitely
that.
Want a case on that iPad. And you want a screen cover on it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, an iPad doesn't have a hard drive. It's a solid state device.
But, you know, so. With the iPad, you know, every app that Jeremy's going to need and such is going to cost a little bit of money. There's not going to be much. I mean, there's some free versions as well. But in general, you're spent more time using it for what it's designed for than playing with it and making it work, right? You will not spend much time making that thing work. A laptop's going to take more time figuring out things. The iPad's just going to either work or it's not going to work. We won't have much choice in the matter.
And the security thing, too, you know, with the iPad, there's less that, oh, well, now you have to install these third-party apps to make sure that
that's
you
right.
don't get something through your
You're
browser.
You're not going to have a problem with viruses and such. That's true.
which can also be another expense. So it always
we, you can tell this that we're you can tell that we're not giving a direct recommendation because we don't have the answer for you.
Right,
trying to
right.
give you what you need as a parent. I would say, I like Jeremy. I say give an iPad.
Yeah. If there's enough equality, I'd say if they want something significantly more than something else, yeah.
Yeah, and it's going to be cheaper for you probably the short term. The long term cost could be a little high. The other thing to be very careful about, and I highly recommend this from a, you know, it's extremely easy to spend a couple thousand dollars on iPad by just getting every app you want. So there should be a lot of consciousness about the App Store and getting stuff. And I think for my kids at this point, I wouldn't give them the password for my iTunes account. I would basically, anytime they want something, they'd have to talk to me, and then I would go ahead and do the purchase if I thought that was necessary. And I do that with my son, who has an iPod. He can't buy things on it. He asks to talk to me, and then I install stuff for him.
Which is a shame that there isn't a two-tier system where you can say the free stuff, you know, put in the password, and that's fine. And then if you want to pay, then you have a second password. Unfortunately, that doesn't exist right now.
And keep in mind that, you know, if you give Jeremy this thing, and then he says, we install this free thing for me? And you go, yeah, and you install it and hand it back to him. There's like a 40-second or two-minute window swing where he can go ahead and buy anything he wants. And then be careful of that, too.
Here's another thing is with the software. You were talking about the schools.
Yeah.
If there's any software applications that they need you to use, you need to make sure it's something that you can be used on Mac. And also, if they need to turn in homework assignments in PDF format or Word, or, you know, if the teacher wants something like that, some documents are not as portable between operating systems.
That iPad will be used a lot in your home. It'll become a media center. You'll start watching movies on it, and it's going to, you know, it'll be a part of your life if you get one, that's for sure.
I've actually started reading books on my iPad, and I actually like it a lot because the books, I have multiple books, they're all in one place, and for that aspect, I wish schools would go in that mode more, where you don't have to carry around a huge backpack of books, that you could just carry this one device and just choose which one you're going to.
At Book Club the other night, somebody was reading the book on the iPad and mentioned the whole time, had all these notes and citations all in there, really easy to flip around.
But until our education system matches up with the technology and has it tailored to that model, there's going to be a disconnect, and so it's hard to really recommend it.
But definitely talk to the school before making a decision.
Okay.
Nimi, thank you so much. That was great chatting with you. Say hi to Jeremy.
Thank you. Yeah, you gave me some good information.
All right, take care.
Thanks, you too. Bye.
Wish there was a way to run.
I would have loved to have carried around a portable book reader like an iPad or even a Kindle, and as opposed to the huge backpack that I had.
For me, I have that whole problem of wanting to have what I need with me all the time. So if someone says, oh, I need a screwdriver and I don't have a screwdriver on me, I feel really bad. It's a horrible thing I've got, right? So he carries
around this dorky Leatherman on his belt all the time. It's really funny looking.
Hey, I'm clean right now. I don't wear it. But exactly, I had this problem in high school where, it's possible that I don't have my history class today. Not that session, whatever. But I'd carry the book. So I'd carry all my books every day and then have a roll-around case. Lindsay, same thing?
I did the same thing. Yeah. I had a huge backpack that probably weighed half what I did.
Yeah,
I carried around everywhere, big old math books. I want to point out that Miles is having a little Pavlovian response over here. He's talking about the heavy books and rubbing his lower back.
Oh, is he? Yeah.
Just thinking about it hurts.
Oh, and just as a quick thing, I also believe that I wish that there were a way to lock down an iPad, or at least for the educational environment, where it turned off spell check.
Why?
And turned off, turned off calculator, turned off things like that.
Grammar checker.
Why?
Because I think that spell check has done bad things for spelling.
Why?
You mean for learning spelling? For people learning it?
To learn how to spell things.
Okay, this is an interesting idea. The human race is a technology race. If you take away our technology, we're not the same species, if you will. There's an argument about that, right? So, especially if someone like you who's modified their vision, like, what is the difference about having a calculator versus having your glasses?
If I take away my glasses, I cannot function ever.
Okay.
If, however, I take away the ability to have a calculator for 3 years of my education, it means that I will have those skills and can augment them later with a calculator, as well as move on to further math, for example.
Okay.
Or if I am writing, that I don't require a word processor to write a sign, to hand paint a sign and do it correctly.
How are you guys' arithmetic and multiplication? How strong is it right now?
I didn't have a calculator, and mine are terrible.
I'd say
why?
I did what I had to do when I had to do it, but I knew I'd be able to use a calculator in real life.
Okay. Thank you.
I've got the Einstein. If you can look it up, don't memorize it.
I think we're going to move on from there. I've been my point. Westside Santa Cruz, Dale, welcome to Geek Speak.
Good morning, geeks. How are you?
Quite well. How are you, Dale?
Well, you know, I'm so glad that you made a couple comments earlier that got me going and thinking about things here. And earlier you mentioned that the 15 and 14-year-olds are now dusting your clocks. That's good to know because I tune into you guys on Saturdays just to get a kind of a brain headache because I can't keep up. I go back to manual typewriters. You know, it's a way for me to try to kind of spur my brain to grow by listening to you guys. So there's a compliment for you, and that raises the question. You mentioned the 17-year-old that just won the prize for being able to detect nuclear weapons and won the prize. Are there any science fairs for, and dear God, I don't want to say this word because I'm not quite there yet, for seniors? Are there any science fairs you know about that spur people who might have some time on their hands and still have some brains in their heads to grow those neurons and push themselves to invent something?
Yes, of the Nobel Prize. However, for the
it's open to everyone. there's definitely communities of people doing fun and neat things. There's makers groups pretty much everywhere. There's people that get together and kind of show off what they're doing. Inventions specifically, like to actually, because most of those environments are, look at this amazing thing. I can now have my dog write things by walking through the park. I'll link to that image. What? I'll link to that story and image on geekspeak.org. You can go look it up. It's really cool. But so there's people that are doing cool things. It's not a product, right? It's not the idea that we're going to have some money come out of this. It's just because why not play at the world a little bit? You know, that's what involve yourself in the world of creation. So in that sense, yeah, there's these great groups. Meetup.com is a site that shows you other people that want to meet together and do things. And they've got it. If you are an underwater basket weaver, there's a meetup group for that in your area, most likely. It's really cool. So I recommend taking a look at finding groups of people that are kind of like-minded and are doing interesting things. Get involved with them, and you'll have a community right around whatever interest you have. Now, Lindsay, what do you think? Get any additions to this?
No, when I look for seniors, it's always high school seniors. So. but most science competition type stuff is open to anybody.
That's true.
And so you can just Google science competition, pretty much anything that you come
up
with.
County fair science exhibits almost always have different age ranges.
Yeah, exactly. I'll have to look.
Fair enough.
It's an interesting question.
Dale, what are you inventing?
What am I inventing? Hey, come on, that's patent infringement.
Oh,
I
see.
Go there.
You don't want to go there, huh? You haven't patented, so okay.
You know what? When I went to the Maker Fair, a lot of the people there are people who have a lot of spare time, you know, to just come up with stuff that they want to come up with. And so that would be a good way to showcase something or get ideas if you have a Maker Fair. I know there's like one on the East Coast and one on the West Coast.
Dale, do you know
a Maker Fair?
Do you know
Maker Fair?
Yeah, do you know Make Magazine, Dale?
No.
Go to your local bookshop, pick up a copy of Make Magazine. They release one every quarter. And it's all about people that make things. And they're really cool.
M-A-K-E.
M-A-K-E. It's by Orion Media. And we've had former shows about it on GeekSpeak if you want to listen to some shows about the editor and such. And twice a year they do a fair where they pull people together and actually have like a county fair event. And they have it in California last month. And they have it in 6 months from there or so in Dallas or something, somewhere in Texas, I think. There you go. Thanks for calling in, Dale.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We got time for one more, I believe. From SoCal, Rich, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi, last month I told you that I was going to install Ubuntu on my wife's laptop, and you asked me to call back and give you a report on how it went.
Are you still married?
I guess I need some help. So I got through most of the steps okay, I think. Mm-hmm. And I got GNOME, is that how you pronounce it? G-N-O-M-E, graphical user interface installed, but I've never gotten it to work. So it basically gives a black screen and then the machine's just dead. And I'm sitting now at the recovery menu And the same thing happens when I go use fail-safe X mode. It puts some stuff up on the screen.
Some text.
Yeah. Which version of Ubuntu were you running?
I think it's 10.10, the latest one.
11.04 is actually the latest one. It was released in April.
Okay.
Was this machine doing a very similar thing before you installed Ubuntu?
No. No. This is just an old Windows machine, and it was kind of bogged down getting updates, and it was slow to do things, and I thought it would be worth trying a lighter weight operating system.
That surprises me. The older machines are usually more responsive.
They usually work better.
So I guess the other feedback I'd give you is that when something goes wrong like this, I feel like I'm in the Wild West. I go online and look up, the symptoms, and there's, 20, 30, 40 people responding to it, but they're all from slightly different versions of Ubuntu or different versions of Linux, and they all have different advice, and none of it seems to work for me, and I don't know quite where to go.
Right, and actually the same thing happens with Windows, just that most people have Windows pre-installed in their system. If they install it from scratch, you'd end up with many of the same
issues. True that the reason why I recommended Ubuntu recently is because I had such an easy experience.
Right.
But it doesn't mean everyone's going to. Where do you go when you need help again for getting something like this running? And I don't have an answer, and that's why I'm asking.
There's a great public community, but
there is,
what were
but
the steps,
this concern?
What were the steps that you went through? Was there a website that you went to in order to follow the installation steps?
There was. I started with Ubuntu and followed the instructions that I found through there. I don't remember exactly
where that was,
but it was at wherever you recommended to start.
Right, Ubuntu. Yeah, it's exactly. And you do have another machine that's functional, so you can be researching as you do this.
Right.
So no matter what happens, when it tries to get into a visual environment, it crashes and burns. It goes black.
Well, with some things, like I've done, there's things online that say how to reinstall X Windows or whatever it's called. And in some states, I can get it to where for the first 30 seconds, the screen has a little flashing cursor at the upper left.
Mm.
And then it goes all black and the machine's dead.
Yeah.
Or sometimes a few milliseconds, it seems like I see the Ubuntu, what I assume is a splash screen.
Go ahead and send some email to us or send a message. Go to our website.
Yeah, we want to help you more.
Okay.
We can probably help out a little bit more.
Unfortunately, we're coming to the end of the show, so thank you for calling.
Okay, thanks.
GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by CruiseIO Internet, offering commuters quiet drop-in office space with a 10 gigabit fiber internet connection. At 877 Cedar Street in downtown Santa Cruz. More information at cruiseio.com. This is GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me, I have Miles Elam and Lindsay Lonnie. Today, answering the phones was Rick. And thank you so much, Rick, for answering the phones. The Homeless Garden Project offers a workshop on container gardening, where you can learn the basics of planting an organic garden and how to creatively use the space you have available. The workshop will take place from 10 a.m. to noon, Saturday, June 25th, at Natural Bridges Farm on Schaefer Road in Santa Cruz. Information is available at 423-1020 or homelessgardenproject.org. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP. We're streaming and podcasting at kosp.org. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used with permission. Everything we talk about on GeekSpeak is available online at geekspeak.org, where you can ask us questions as well. And hopefully, Rich will do that from SoCal so we can help him out continue his Linux dilemma. If you have additions or changes or updates for this show, please let us know so we can correct what we do. Thank you so much for listening to GeekSpeak. We'll be here next week, as we are every week, for KOSP and for GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxell. See you soon.